Hi again, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian, and I'm the co-director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's. And I'm joined once again by my friend and colleague, Mark DiGirolami, the center's co-director, for another episode of Legal Spirits, our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived on our website, lawandreligionforum, that's one word, .org, or also on Apple iTunes. Well, today, Mark, we're going to talk about oral argument in Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue, which was argued last month at the Supreme Court. We've done a previous podcast on this case, of course, and it is an important case. So we thought we'd do another podcast now to break down the oral argument and see how things are shaping up at the court. So we're going to do three things today. We're going to remind listeners about the facts of the case. We're going to talk about the questioning from the justices and see if that suggests where the justices might be going. And then at the very end, we're going to speculate, which is always a dangerous thing to do after oral argument, but we're brave, if not foolhardy. We're going to speculate about what we think the outcome is going to look like and the rationale that the court might adopt in the case. So how about that, Mark? Why don't you start us off first and remind our listeners about the background of the case?
Okay, great. So listeners who have listen to our previous podcast, this is going to be familiar territory, but just to get sort of everybody on the same page, and because the facts are a little bit, the facts and the procedural posture are a little bit strange in this case. In fact, the posture is something that we're going to talk about a little bit, I think, Mark.
Yes.
Let's go over some of the basics. So what you have in the case is a 2015 Montana law that provides for tax credits of up to $150 for taxpayers who donate money to something called a student scholarship organization. And these student scholarship organizations can then provide parents and students with scholarships for the children to attend private schools. And the private schools can be secular private schools or religious private schools.
But we should say these are religiously affiliated schools. You know, we say religious schools, but they are K-12 schools, which are accredited by the state for general education purposes. They're not training them in some sort of religious way.
Absolutely right. No, I think that's important. And these are sort of, you know, quote unquote, ordinary schools. They just happen to be religiously affiliated, but they teach students the normal subjects. They are accredited. It's just that they have a religious affiliation, and some will have, religious services or religious programs that they will institute as part of the educational program. So after this, the Montana Department of Revenue concludes that this statute, this 2015 Montana law, is unconstitutional under the Montana Constitution,
and specifically, right, Mark.
Yeah. So it's Blaine Amendment.
Right.
And if you remember, Mark, we talked about this last time. The history of the Blaine Amendment. All of the sort of anti-religious and anti-Catholic bias with respect to some of this history. But the Montana version, the Montana Blaine Amendment, forbids the distribution of public money, quote, for any sectarian purpose or to aid any church, school, academy, seminary, college, university, or other literary or scientific institution controlled in whole or in part by any church, sect, or denomination.
Right.
So that's the language of the Montana Constitution's Blaine Amendment. The Department of Revenue adopts a rule excluding religious schools from the program in order ostensibly to make it compliant with this provision of the Montana Constitution.
Correct. And the Montana Supreme Court said that as a matter of state law, that the state constitution does forbid this because even though the money is not going directly to a religiously affiliated school, it's going indirectly, and the money is being incentivized, if that's a word, it's being incentivized by these tax credits.
That's right.
And so for purposes of Montana law, this is a violation of the Montana state constitution.
That's right. The court says basically we've got a more stringent constitution in Montana than what the United States constitution permits, but at any rate, it's consistent with what the United States Constitution requires. It's just that it demands more separation.
Right. And so at this point, the petitioners in the case, who are parents who wanted to use the scholarships to send their kids to a Christian school, a Protestant school, by the way, not a Catholic school, they then sued, they actually sought certiorari in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right. Now, hang on, Mark. I just want to mention one other thing. So one wrinkle in this case, which is going to be important to talk about with respect to what the Montana Supreme Court did, is that rather than simply upholding the Department of Revenue rule distinguishing between aid to secular and sectarian schools, the Montana court struck the entire program down. So at this point, there is this tax credit program is dead as to both religious and secular private schools.
Yeah, that's a good point, Mark, and that is going to come up in a little bit. So once the Montana Supreme Court said that they couldn't use these scholarships at religiously affiliated schools, and as you say, actually the Montana Supreme Court said the whole program was unconstitutional, and we should note, it said the program was unconstitutional because there was no way to assure that state money would not go to religiously affiliated schools. That's why it was struck down.
That's right.
The petitioners then sought cert at the U.S. Supreme Court, and they claimed that excluding them from this state scholarship program because they were going to use the money at a religiously affiliated school violated the federal constitution, specifically the free exercise clause of the First Amendment.
Parenthetically, something, Mark, that the Montana Supreme Court spent very, very little time talking about. I mean, it just kind of glossed over the federal constitutional analysis, and that was sort of the end of it.
Yeah, really an inadequate treatment. I mean, they dealt with this very significant and, frankly, very complicated question of federal constitutional law, like in a sentence or two. And I just can't remember something like that in the past, and really not the right way to handle these things.
Okay, good. So that's the background. Now let's talk a little bit about what kinds of questions emerged in the argument, in the oral argument, Mark. What did you see?
Well, Justice Ginsburg began the oral argument. She was very active, and she got into it right away. And she started suggesting that there really isn't standing in this case. That is, the petitioners lack standing to bring this case, and the court shouldn't even reach the merits of the claim. So, Mark, why don't you address Justice Ginsburg's concern?
Well, so look, I mean, I think it is correct. I think it's ordinarily the rule that somebody does not have standing to challenge tax rules that affect other people. And in this case, the law is granting a tax break to taxpayers who contribute to this fund. So here, Justice Ginsburg said it's the parents that get the money. It's not even the schools that get the money. So she seemed to be suggesting that she's thinking that the case ought to be dismissed on standing grounds. But of course, ultimately, it is the schools that get the money in the form of tuition payments. So I'm not certain why going from a situation in which they would have received money to a situation in which they don't receive money because of the Montana Supreme Court's interpretation of the Blaine Amendment means that they don't have standing, means that they haven't suffered a concrete injury.
Yeah, I agree, Mark. I was perplexed by this argument. I mean, to me, it seems very straightforward. And actually, Justice Gorsuch made this point during argument. You have these parents. They would have been entitled to this scholarship money, except for the fact that they were going to use it at a religiously affiliated school. Now, as a result of what the Montana Department of Revenue did, they can't use that money. It seems to me that's a clear injury, and they're making a constitutional claim. So I just don't see a majority of the justices going along with Justice Ginsburg on this. Do you, Mark?
No, I don't. But look, I mean, so there's a possibly a related point here that related to the standing argument. So the claims about standing might be connected to a second and maybe stronger stream of argument that was advanced most strongly, I think, by Justice Kagan. And that is, where is the discriminatory harm to the petitioners? So that's a kind of, I wouldn't call it a standing argument, but it's an argument about what exactly the injury is here.
Well, that is a standing argument of a sort. It could be a mootness argument also.
Right. I mean, so as we said, what the Montana Supreme Court did was to strike down this program altogether. And the result is no schools receive the benefit of the statute's money, and that's whether the secular schools or whether the religious schools. So the question put by Justice Kagan is, how can it be that a state is required by the Constitution to institute a program like this for religious schools? Right now, secular and religious schools are both being treated the same way.
Right. Now, Justice Alito had, I thought, a pretty powerful answer to this one, Mark.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, he said, under some Supreme Court precedent, mostly he talked about Equal Protection Clause precedent. While it may be constitutional for government to take certain kinds of actions as an initial matter, it can become unconstitutional for them to take those same actions on the basis of improper or discriminatory motives or reasons. So there are Supreme Court cases that say that, and that is certainly one way to characterize what happened here in this case.
Right. There are Supreme Court cases on that, Mark. You're right about that. There are some cases that point the other way, too. I'm sure our listeners will point those out to us, some of them. But I think in a way, as I thought about this, Mark, I think that argument that Justice Kagan is making, it may go to an equal protection claim. I'm not sure it goes to the petitioner's free exercise claim, because for that purpose, it doesn't really matter that other non-religiously affiliated schools or other parents who want to send their kids to non-religious affiliated schools, it doesn't matter that they are also suffering. That doesn't lessen the free exercise injury to these petitioners. So I'm not convinced that the majority of the court will go along with this, either because they accept what Justice Alito is saying about these equal protection cases like Arlington Heights, or because it just doesn't seem relevant to the free exercise claim.
Well, let me ask you this on that narrower point about what's relevant to the free exercise claim. I take it that, or would you agree that if the state had never done any of this, right, if the statute had never passed, that the petitioners couldn't bring a constitutional claim saying that not having a tax credit system would violate their free exercise rights?
I agree with that. I don't think if Montana had done nothing at all, I don't think that a parent who wants to send his or her child to a religiously affiliated school can say that the state has an obligation to give any money whatsoever for that.
Okay, well then it seems to me that the issue is the differential treatment, right?
So
that,
correct.
So without the history, then it's Justice Alito's point, right? Without the history of what happened here and the differential treatment and the resolution of the case, quote unquote, by the Montana Supreme Court by wiping out the program entirely, there would be no claim.
Right. I guess, yes, that's true. So maybe the way to say it is the injury is the denial of equal access to these scholarship funds. That's the injury. And if the state remedies it by denying scholarships to everyone, that injury is still there, I think.
Right. Right. Right.
But as I think about it, maybe Justice Kagan does have something of a point here. Maybe she can convince some people. Maybe it's a more powerful argument than I thought.
Yeah, it's a tricky issue, I think, and the court's going to have to grapple with it. And I think at least it wouldn't surprise me if that was the sort of pressure point that we'll talk about who's going to be in the majority and who's going to dissent.
Right.
But that at least some justices will seize on to say that this case should be affirmed and that'll be the end of it. So that's
right.
Anyway, that's the second kind of stream of argument or theme that one could find in the case. A third one involved the issue of how close this case is to Trinity Lutheran versus Comer. So Mark, you remember that case?
Well, I do, but I also want to just alert our listeners. So now we're moving away from standing mootness arguments to the actual merits. So now we're assuming then that the justices get past these procedural problems and actually get into the merits of this case.
Yep, that's exactly right. So the Trinity Lutheran stream of argument relates to the merits. And if listeners remember, we've done podcasts on Trinity Lutheran before, but that case involved Missouri's denial of a publicly available fund to schools to resurface playgrounds. But the monies were denied to religious schools on the basis that doing that that granting such monies would violate Missouri's Blaine Amendment, which is similar to, but not identical to, Montana's. It's actually in some ways less objectionable because it doesn't use the language of sectarian and so on. But the Supreme Court ended up striking down that policy. That is the policy of differential treatment, because it said that Missouri was discriminating on the basis of religious status. So right. You can see a kind of at least a surface analogy to what's going on here. But that is to say that, again, the Montana Supreme Court was discriminating on the basis of the Montana Blaine Amendment on the basis of religious status, basically saying, well, because of our exclusion of religious institutions, sectarian institutions as religious, we're going to strike the whole thing down.
Right. And so you could look at Trinity Lutheran and you could say this is a case very much like Trinity Lutheran and therefore should come out the same way. That is, the petitioner should win. At oral argument, though, Justice Kagan, again, and Justice Breyer, I think, supported her on this, tried to distinguish this case, Espinoza, from Trinity Lutheran. And her argument was Trinity Lutheran is not analogous because Trinity Lutheran involved a grant program for school playground refurbishment, which is a secular use totally unrelated to the religious character of the recipient. But here, the Montana program was giving unrestricted scholarship funds to be used at religiously affiliated schools. And so it's much more like the state funding religious education, and that's a different sort of thing.
Yeah, and there was an interesting sort of back and forth among the justices about this, whether this is really, you know, how close this case is to Trinity Lutheran. One justice, actually, I can't remember who it was, basically said, well, what if you, it could have been Justice Alito, what if you just had, Catholic school board members or like the board of trustees, and that's it, right? Otherwise, the school was similar, but it had a Catholic affiliation as a result. And would that be good enough for the state to deny these monies under the Blaine Amendment? And I think given the breadth of the Blaine Amendment, the point that I believe, again, it was Justice Alito was trying to make, is that this has nothing to do with religious education as such. It has to do more with religious status.
Yes.
So this is sort of the argument on the other side, I think.
Right, Mark. I think the debate's going to come down to how closely this case resembles Trinity Lutheran. Now, there is another case that we should talk about that Justice Kagan can cite, and this is a case called Locke versus Davy, in which the Supreme Court really did say at one point, well, if a state wants to deny funding for certain kinds of religious education, then it can do that. But Mark, then the argument is that Locke isn't actually analogous here either, right?
Right. Well, so the question is Locke more like, you could think about this case as somewhere on the spectrum between Locke and Trinity Lutheran. Locke involved training of the clergy, which is a very specific issue, right? I mean, an academic program specifically for the training of ministers. The playground resurfacing case is about playgrounds. And this is a program about, religious schools generally. So, look, I mean, I think it is true that no matter what, Alito's point to me was powerful, which is that the Blaine Amendment cuts more broadly than just talking about for the purpose of religious education. It talks about any money to any sectarian school for any reason, including, I should think, the identity of the people at the school. So if that's the characterization that we go with, then it seems like it's a little closer to Trinity Lutheran than to Locke versus Davy.
Right. And, Locke versus Davy involves, there was a guy who wanted to use public scholarship funds to take a course in devotional theology as part of his training to be a minister. And the court said a state could certainly say, establishment issues there, we don't want to get involved with that. But it didn't say you couldn't use the money at a religiously affiliated school, which is what we're doing here. And also, money for clergy, we have a traditional antipathy for this in America, going all the way back to the memorial by Madison with respect to the Virginia tax assessment in the 1780s. So clergy training is somewhat different.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. That's a nice point. And it stands, that kind of issue stands more at the very, very center of what the Establishment Clause, at least historically, was all about, which is for the government not to get involved in the training and selection of ministers at particular churches, right? So it seems to me that's, as you say, historically and traditionally, more just the kind of practice that was deemed constitutionally problematic.
Right. Now, there's one other case we just want to throw in, at least I want to throw in, a case called Zelman from 2002, which says that there's not an Establishment Clause problem if the money goes to religiously affiliated schools because of the choice of the parents themselves, the wholly unrestrained choice of the parents. And that is an issue here too, I think, Mark, because here, after all, the money is going to the religiously affiliated school, not directly from the state, but because parents decide to use otherwise available funds for this sort of education. And yep. I think that's also got to play a role here.
Yeah, no, I think that you're probably right about that. And one difference with respect to Zelman, of course, is that was about the interpretation of the federal Establishment Clause, right? There was no sort of additional layer of state, quote unquote protection, what the Montana Supreme Court called protection, that the Supreme Court then had to deal with. So while Zelman was just a straight up Establishment Clause issue, federal Establishment Clause issue, this case looks like it's really going to be about the Free Exercise Clause side of things with respect to the restraints imposed by the Montana Blaine Amendment.
Yeah, very good. Okay, so let's get to the third part of our podcast, which is predicting what's going to happen.
You go first.
I'll go first. I've been foolhardy about this. I actually put this in a blog post, so I'm already out there on the record. I think the court is likely to get past the standing and mootness issues, the procedural issues. I think it'll reach the merits. And I can see a 5-4 vote in favor of petitioners, a narrow ruling that says this case lines up very closely with Trinity Lutheran, and therefore the petitioners win. I think there will be at least one dissent by Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor. I think also probably by Justices Kagan and Breyer, who joined the court in Trinity Lutheran, but I think are not going to be persuaded this is the same thing. So that's what I would guess, Mark. What about you?
Yeah, that seems pretty plausible, actually. I mean, Justice Breyer is a hard one to figure out. I mean, I always have a hard time with his questions. These questions are always interesting and provocative, and he comes up with difficult hypos. And like in this argument, he said, well, you know, what about a general requirement of funding religious schools full stop? You know, is that something that are you leading us in this direction, right? So it's hard to figure out exactly where it is that he'll fall. Of course, it's hard to figure out where any of the justices will fall just based on argument, but I've always find him particularly difficult. But in general, I think he tends to line up. He's been lining up with Justice Kagan's position. I might see, I agree with you that they'll get to the merits, but I might see 4 votes for the Justice Kagan led, where's the harm sort of challenge to getting to the merits. So you might get, I don't think you're going to get a majority for that view. You know, the Chief Justice did ask a couple of questions about that issue, you know, the Justice Kagan, where's the harm question. But ultimately, I mean, difficult to know with a chief always, but I don't think that he's going to line up with what I expect to be 4 dissenters on that question. And yeah, on the merits, I think that it's likely that we're going to get to something like a 5-4, and I suspect petitioners will win.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's leave it there, Mark. So, listeners, let's keep talking about this. We'll keep an eye on this case and the other. There's some other important law and religion cases at the court this term we're also going to keep an eye on. So please stay tuned for future podcasts. For now, along with Mark DiGirolami, this has been Mark Movsesian from the St. John's Center for Law and Religion. See you next time.